From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now, here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The national debate on immigration is perhaps being most felt in California, home to nearly a quarter of the nation's undocumented immigrants. That's over 2 million undocumented immigrants, constituting more than 6% of the state's population. What is the impact on education, jobs, social services, and crime? And what about the plight of the Dreamers under DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the ongoing debate about a path to citizenship, and the state's sanctuary policy? We'll ask Laura Hill with the Public Policy Institute of California, Taryn Luna with the Sacramento Bee, and Dan Walters with Cal Matters.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Immigration has been the center of national and state politics for some time now. There's been a lot of commentary, but what are the facts when it comes to immigration and immigration policies? Our guest is Laura Hill from the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, one of the leading authorities, actually, on immigration issues. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk numbers. How many undocumented immigrants call California home?
The estimates are between about 2.4 and 2.6 million. And that number is obviously pretty large.
But that's out of a population of, 39 million?
That's right. They're about 6% of the population in California. And nationally, there are about 11 million undocumented immigrants.
So it varies from county to county, I assume. So which California counties have the greatest number and the greatest proportion of immigrants? Or undocumented, specifically undocumented residents?
They actually kind of mirror the counties for immigrants as well. So, you know, our large counties have larger numbers of undocumented immigrants. So Los Angeles County is up there at the top.
And looking at your statistics, like 814,000 undocumented, that's quite a large number.
That's right.
Almost a million.
That's right. But as a percentage of the county, it's actually not one of the highest, actually. Monterey and San Bernardino counties are two counties that are more like 12% of their population is undocumented immigrants. And that's compared to about 6% for the state on average.
And I'm guessing if you look at places like the San Joaquin Valley, it's going to be along those higher numbers.
There are higher percentages in some of those counties, that's right. But the numbers of residents are obviously smaller.
Right, but the percentage is quite large because they are attracted to certain industries like agriculture, for example, and so the numbers will be larger.
That's true. But Santa Clara County is actually right up there with about 10% of the population being undocumented.
Can you explain why that is?
Well, I think Santa Clara County has a lot of the industries that are popular among undocumented immigrants. There's the service work, and there's also construction, and there can be some movement between agricultural settings like in Monterey and San Benito and different kind of hospitality things in Santa Clara.
It's kind of expensive to live there. I'm a little surprised.
It is expensive to live there. I'm not an expert on all of those issues, but definitely you hear stories about overcrowding and substandard housing all over the state.
Or very, very long commutes.
Or very long commutes.
That's right. So it's interesting, reading your materials, that the undocumented population is actually declining since 2007. You know, that probably surprised a lot of people.
It does because they're so popular, such a popular topic in the news these days. But yeah, the population is definitely down from the peak of 2007. And I think there are two things happening. One is fewer undocumented immigrants are coming. That probably started with the Great Recession from 2007 to 2009. There were fewer opportunities for work, and that's really the draw for most undocumented immigrants. And the other thing that's happening is increased deportations, and that's not just a phenomenon with the Trump administration.
That was happening with the Obama administration
as
well.
That's right. That was happening then, too.
So where are these undocumented immigrants coming from to either the U.S. generally or California specifically?
Where in the state are they coming?
No,
or
no.
Where are they coming from?
What nations are they coming from?
So they have largely been coming from Mexico. But recently, there's been a little bit of a change. That's still the predominant sending country, but fewer undocumented immigrants from Mexico have been coming lately, and that we've seen increases in numbers of undocumented immigrants coming from Central America and Asia. So that means in California right now, the percentage of our undocumented immigrants that are from Mexico is around 70%. Nationally, it's about 50%, and that's a decline from prior years.
You were mentioning earlier that the reason why undocumented immigrants come here is for economic opportunity, for jobs.
Right.
What percentage of the California workforce are undocumented workers? Are they also attracted? I'm assuming they're attracted to certain industries like ag and construction, et cetera.
Yeah, they're about 9% of the California workforce. And recall, they're just about 6% of the California population. And I think that's at least two things happening. One is the reason undocumented immigrants are coming is to work. So we shouldn't be surprised to see them kind of overrepresented in the workforce. And second, undocumented immigrants are prime working age. They're much more likely to be in the 18 to 64 age range than Californians in general.
I'm wondering, how much unemployment exists with undocumented? Is it larger than the normal population, or is it similar?
That's a great question that I can't really answer off the top of my
head. It's probably
hard
to know because they have to report that, right? So that's kind of difficult.
Yeah. So our estimates about undocumented immigrants and participation in the workforce come from national surveys by and large. And so it's pretty hard to get down into the granularity of that in particular regions in California. Certainly, when we look from the flip side at employment and poverty, during the Great Recession, we saw that Latino low-skill immigrants were behind in terms of earnings, but that's a different thing than saying they were more unemployed.
You know, one of the arguments is that undocumented immigrants are taking, American jobs, quote unquote. Is that true?
Undocumented immigrants are, by and large, quite low-skilled. So many have not graduated from high school, and English is not proficient for them in many cases. And so they're really not competing with most Americans or most Californians for the jobs that those folks are interested in.
You know, another argument, I'll just end here, we've only about 20 seconds left in the segment, that is government benefits. One of the arguments is they come here for government benefits. Is that true?
Many California and federal benefits are not available for undocumented immigrants. U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants are eligible for benefits, but
okay, so it's kind of bifurcated. It's bifurcated. Okay, very good. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the children brought to the United States by undocumented parents. What happens to those folks? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddy Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddy Institute. You know, many undocumented immigrants live with family members who are legal residents. According to estimates by the Mitigation Policy Institute, more than 5 million children in the U.S. have an undocumented parent. Most of these children, 79%, are U.S. citizens, according to our guest, Laura Hill, from the nonpartisan PPIC. So these statistics indicate that a good number of children in California schools come from families with an undocumented immigrant. What are the numbers?
It's about 12.3% of K through 12 school children are undocumented in California, and that's probably over 800,000 students in the state.
And that impacts, I'm guessing, the scores of some of those schools, because these kids are having probably a little more difficult time in school.
We don't look at them separately in any of the data that's collected by the state. Many of them are likely to be English learners. We do have a variety of curriculum in place to help English learners catch up.
And the state has been focusing on that with the local control funding formula. The governor's made an attempt to, the legislature and the governor made an attempt to kind of fund those programs more. Let me kind of switch let's talk about DACA.
Sure.
The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, been in the news a lot lately. Can you briefly describe the program and the number of young people who are affected nationally and also in California?
So nationally, it's about 800,000 young people who have successfully applied for DACA. And in California, it's something like 230,000 that have successfully applied. So again, we're at about a quarter or more of the undocumented immigrants that fall into the DACA category.
A large number.
It is a large number. And the DACA program, what it does is provides a way for young people who came to the United States while children, so before they turned 16, to apply for protection from deportation, and also allows them to be eligible for work permits. So many of these young people were able to come out of the shadows and work and continue their educations. And it's not just those two requirements about age and the arrival and how old they are now, but they also have to demonstrate that they have not committed any kinds of crimes that disqualify them, and they need to have been continuing their education.
But they have to provide this information. So you said they're coming out of the shadows. They now provide that they've provided this information, and they're probably wondering, now what? If DACA ends, now the government has all this information. They know that they're here. You know, they're undocumented.
Mm-hmm. I think they're worried for themselves and also for their family members, because many of them are with parents who are likely to still be undocumented.
Yeah, so there gets to the whole issue of this ongoing debate about undocumented immigrants and the path to citizenship. It's been hotly debated. Where are Californians on that issue?
Californians now are in favor of offering a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. I believe it's something like 68% of Californians that have said they favor a path to citizenship. So Californians, you know, the state that has the most experience with undocumented immigrants looks a little different from some other parts of the country.
And that you guys have been polling this for some time. Mm-hmm. And what's the trend line been over time? Have Californians become more amenable to seeing undocumented have a pathway to citizenship? Has it gone down? Has it just stayed the same?
I think it's been, in recent years, it's been pretty steady. And there are other questions that we've asked about, should there be a way for citizens to be able, for undocumented immigrants to stay in the country? And it's been about 82%. And then this becoming a citizen question is about 68%.
So they're not wanting to kick undocumented immigrants out of the country.
They're not. And in September, the survey actually asked if Californians were in favor of the protections afforded by DACA. And again, a majority of Californians answered that they were after it had been announced that the plans were to cancel it.
Yeah, because the experience here is different. Also, a lot of these industries rely on it. You also have business groups and ag groups, for example, supporting immigration reform because their workforce comes from there.
And the estimates that we've done in the state show that these are Californians across many, many communities. So these are neighbors, these are schoolmates, these are coworkers.
Are we going to see these issues go away in the near term? Or this is going to be continuing on, this conversation?
I thought when I started working on the issue, we were close to the end of it, you know, over a decade ago, and it doesn't feel like it.
The last immigration reform was, 1986?
That's right.
Major immigration reform.
It's been a little while.
That was supposed to solve the issue, and I guess it didn't.
It did not.
So we will be talking about it, it sounds like.
Well,
up next, immigration has been an active issue in the legislature. What passed, what didn't, and why? A conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. Lawmakers at the state capitol spent most of the last year taking shots at immigration policies coming out of Washington, pledging to protect California's undocumented community with legislation of their own. Some were signed into law, some not. Our guest is Taryn Luna with the Sacramento Bee, who has a front row seat, hasn't had a front row seat to the policy debates, and we're delighted to have her join us. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you for having me.
So the signature law that came out of the Capitol this year was SB 54, the state sanctuary policy. It was hotly debated. How would it work?
So the state can do very little to curtail federal activities, federal immigration enforcement within California, right? So the general idea is that they're focusing on limiting what state and local police can do and how they can assist the federal government with immigration enforcement. So the bill makes it so that police can't inquire about someone's immigration status, they can't participate in border patrol activities, they can't be deputized as immigration agents, unless someone is wanted on a federal warrant or they have committed one of more than 800 different crimes that are carved out in the bill.
So that was a big addition added by the governor at the governor's insistence. He increased that number of crimes that were covered.
Yeah, there were some 60 crimes that were kind of considered carve-outs initially. So if you committed one of these crimes, then a lot of these protections were kind of wiped away. The governor intervened and expanded that list to over 800 different crimes.
That's quite an expansion.
It is quite an expansion. It was really worried a lot of the advocates who were kind of supporting the bill along the way. And it allows you to notify the federal government if someone's being released and they have committed some of these crimes.
One of those 800 crimes, or if they have a federal warrant.
Yes, exactly.
So there were some groups that were opposed to this. Who were they and why were they opposed?
The main opponent of the bill was the California Sheriff's Association. They largely didn't like the way that they thought it restricted their ability to enforce immigration violations or to help the federal government. They wanted to be able to continue to work on task forces. They argued that by saying that the federal agents couldn't work with them in their jails, that it would then push people out and push them into the streets and go into communities and homes and things like that, and then kind of rounding up people who are generally law-abiding citizens who then, you know, kind of fall through the cracks.
At the end of the day, though, I think it might have been in one of your articles, the head of the California Sheriff's Association said that he thought that the governor dealt with the bulk of the problem when he added these additional laws.
Yeah, so we saw some early amendments that the sheriffs wanted, and it was largely a strikeout of almost the entire bill. In the end, Jerry Brown did remedy a lot of the different things that they wanted, but they still remained opposed. They also, the LA Times at one point had reported that they were working with ICE to kind of oppose the bill and to try to kill the bill. So I think it was kind of a fundamental opposition in a lot of ways.
Okay. So there were other immigration laws that were passed and signed into law. What were some of the other laws that were signed into law this year?
One is AB 450, which keeps federal authorities out of private workplaces unless they have a judicial warrant. Another one, SB 31, was meant to curtail Trump's Muslim registry, which would prohibit public employees from providing information for a registry based on religion, national origin, or ethnicity. Another bill would have made it illegal, or which was passed, made it illegal for landlords to essentially out your immigration status or threaten to out your immigration status.
That's a way for someone, if they were complaining about their apartment or something like that, they say, better not complain or we're going to report you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the water is leaking or whatnot, and you can't really complain or do a whole lot about it.
There were also some other immigration proposals that were passed by the legislature, but they were not signed into law. Or maybe even didn't pass both houses of the legislature. What were some of those that didn't make it?
So some that didn't pass the legislature were kind of interesting. One was meant to kind of stop the border wall by preventing the state from awarding contracts to any company that essentially provided goods or services to the border wall's construction. That didn't even pass the legislature.
It's almost like blackballing those companies. If they get involved, they make a bid, then they're out of the equation for state projects.
Yeah, it was a Ricardo Lara bill, and that was kind of the general idea was, you know, if you take on these, you work with federal government for this to build the wall, then you can kind of count out all future state contracts.
Right, okay. Any other ones that were talked about in the legislature but didn't make it?
Another that didn't pass the legislature would have prohibited the disclosure of information that undocumented immigrants could provide for college grants, driver's license, medical care, and public services and things like that, which also failed in the legislature.
Do you think we're going to see more of this in the next year?
I don't get the sense that lawmakers are done here. I think that they'll continue to push next year. Some of these things that didn't pass, they've already promised to bring back in a different form next year.
You know, that happens a lot. They bring it up in 1 year, doesn't make it, but they're dogging about it. They'll bring it back the next year.
The benefit of a 2-year session, yes, you always get a second shot.
There you go. Well, thank you very much. Up next, we're going to talk about immigration politics with veteran political observer Dan Walters of Cal Matters. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. Given the state's changing demographics, it's no surprise that immigration has become a political hot potato. But does what passes for good politics pass for good policy? We're joined by veteran political observer Dan Walters of Cal Matters. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thank you.
So you've written that it's time for Californians to, quote unquote, take a chill pill when it comes to DACA and other immigration issues. Why?
Well, I think it's becoming kind of an obsession with California politicians, and I think it'll become very evident in next year's elections that all you're going to hear is Trump, 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 Trump. And yeah, it plays well, particularly within the Democratic Party, particularly with Democratic Party interest groups. But look, California's got a lot of issues, starting with the housing crisis, for example. And it's maybe gratifying and emotionally satisfactory to do all this Trump stuff, but it doesn't get you there when stuff that Trump has nothing to do with housing crisis. He has nothing to do with a lot of the other issues that face California. We still have transportation problems. We still have education problems. We still have water problems. We have all sorts of things going on that have absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump. And it seems to me that the first responsibility of California politicians is to take care of California's issues and not just posture. Yes, they get some lots of national publicity. They get to go on national TV shows. They get to do this and that. But what's that do for California?
Well, the counter would be there's 200,000 Californians that are dreamers, for example, that are affected by DACA. So, and the families that are affected. It impacts
I'm not saying ignore the issue. I'm just saying put it in perspective. Yeah, and also, it's possible that the militancy in California, on particularly on immigration issues, may be counterproductive.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. You talked about sanctuary state, the sanctuary state issue, and how that might come back and bite California. How so?
Well, we have to keep our eye on the bottom line. The bottom line of all this should be some sort of immigration reform that makes those folks that are in California and other states illegally, but they're otherwise law-abiding and productive citizens. There should be some pathway to legalization and perhaps citizenship, and that can only be done by Congress. California can't do that. It can try all it wants to semi-legalize people, but they're not legal until the federal government says they're legal. And by taking the attitude that California has, it kind of invites backlash elsewhere in the country and in Congress. And, you know, it's you kind of wonder sometimes whether people are waving this bloody shirt just to be waving the bloody shirt, or they're really trying to do something about the issue itself, and that the people who are in the country illegally, undocumented, the Dreamers and everyone else, may be just being pawns in some gigantic political game. But remember, it's real life to them. It really affects their life, and the goal should be to make life easier for them, not to just stir up political angst.
You know, it seems like the immigration issue is something that's dividing business. Business and ag seem to be on one side of that equation, and the Republicans, some of the more populist wings of the Republican Party seem to be on the other side of the issue. Is that going to split the California Republican Party?
More than it's already split? Yes, of course. It is an issue that divides business and agriculture from, I guess, the real true believing red blood Republicans, I guess we could say. But so that be. I mean, it the business and agricultural position reflects the reality. The reality is we have several million undocumented immigrants in California. They play integral roles in the California economy. We would be stuck in many respects, particularly agriculture.
Yeah, you think about agriculture, it's
tourism,
huge.
People who work
construction.
In restaurants, construction, hotels, they're doing jobs that need to be done in the economy that don't pay very much money, and a lot of people are not going to be willing to fill that hole. So let's just recognize it, and I think the business and ag communities see that, and they say, hey, let's get real here, and that is real. Yes, it may divide the Republican Party, but so what? They're divided on all other issues as
well. So the idealists versus the pragmatists, maybe. So this hardline stance that some people in the Republican Party in California are taking, if they continue down that path, are they going to seal the fate of the Republican Party in California for another generation?
More than it's already been sealed? Yeah, I mean, they will. They'll isolate themselves more and more from the California mainstream and become less and less relevant as time goes on. You know, the funny thing is these things turn very quickly. It's only been slightly over 20 years ago that Democrats were worried that the immigration issue was going to backfire on them, and they were scampering to do things like cut off driver's license to illegal immigrants and so forth. So these things turn very quickly, but I think in this particular case, yes, the Republicans are on the wrong side, as it were, and will do nothing but suffer more losses because of it.
You think it's going to temper, though, some of the Republican candidates' positions on immigration as we go to the next election? I mean, they're looking at the demographics of their districts, and they're saying maybe we can't take that hardline
stance. Well, it already is. You have Republican congressmen from agricultural areas, for example, Mr. Valdeo and so forth, who are already split from the party, I guess the party mainstream, on that issue. They see the reality in their own districts. They see the reality in their own political fortunes, that Latinos are a large part of their constituency, and they don't want to alienate them. So, I mean, you're already seeing that happen quite a bit, as a matter of fact.
Well, I want to thank Dan Walters for Cal Matters joining us, as well as Laura Hill from PPIC and Taryn Luna from the Sacramento Bee. If you want to stay up with state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The immigration issue, together with the Me Too movement against sexual harassment, is resulting in more children of immigrants and women running for higher office. One has even thrown her hat in the ring to be the next governor of California. Who is Amanda Renteria? We'll find out next.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
With Governor Jerry Brown termed out in 2018, the first hurdle to replace him, the June primary, will soon be upon us. While the focus has been on the top Democratic contenders, former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom and former LA Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, and the leading Republican candidate, San Diego businessman John Cox, a new candidate has emerged. Could the late entry of a Stanford and Harvard-educated Latina from the Central Valley completely change the race? We'll ask Democratic candidate for governor, Amanda Renteria.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. It appeared the race to replace Governor Jerry Brown, who's termed out in 2018, was somewhat settled. That is, until our guest, former Chief of Operations for the California Department of Justice, Amanda Renteria, threw her hat in the ring kind of at the last minute. So who is Amanda Renteria, and what is the likelihood that she is going to be able to take this unorthodox bid for governor all the way to the top two primary in June? So welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. It's good to be back in the Central Valley.
So, interesting. Your candidacy came up pretty late, and it raised some eyebrows. So political observers said, well, you haven't held political office, so you may not be known statewide. You lack some ID. And your campaign rollout was a bit unconventional. Didn't have a press conference, didn't have kind of the traditional campaign infrastructure you typically see with a rollout. Some say, you know, what's going on here is you're a spoiler. I mean, you're trying to help Antonio Villaraigosa, take votes away from Newsom in the Valley. But then, again, you came out against Newsom on some things. So people are a little confused. So what do you think in terms of your opportunity for success in starting a campaign this kind of late in the game?
Yeah, well, first of all, on all the rumors that were out there, that's just indicative of what people hate about politics. The idea that someone doesn't run for politics because they really mean it, because they want to be a part of making sure that they can make the world better for others. And as a longtime public servant, the idea that I believe more chiefs of staff, I believe more chief of operations should run. And the reason is because when you are that person, you're the person that's focused on the work. It's not your name on the door. It's, are you waking up every single day and connecting the work of public service to the people? And I believe that that is what people are looking for right now. And I'm looking forward to talking to more voters. You can go direct to voters today. That's what's so exciting about this.
Was there some event that kind of spurred you on and you said, I'm going to jump in? What is there some event that happened?
Yeah, so I've talked a lot, quite a bit about this, which is in January, there was the Women's March, pretty big Women's March in LA. Mm-hmm. And just a week later, down the street, there was then a debate. No mention of women, no mention of the women's movement, no mention of what are you doing to inspire a whole new generation. And as I was sitting in the audience thinking, really, this is what's going to lead our state?
We're not talking about the things that people are really marching in the streets for. We're not talking about the Central Valley where I'm from. I mean, when you really think about the state of California and you think about, you know, someone that's grown up in the poorest, one of the poorest counties in our state, and we're not talking about the Central Valley and the Central Valley doesn't have a voice, you really got to say someone's got to step up and be there.
Well, so let me ask you this. So what's your vision for California? Broad vision.
Right. So I have said this from the beginning, wherever I go, we've truly got to be one California. And that requires a couple of things. Number one, we've got to change the culture of our politics. If we really want to be one state that's on the leading edge of progress, that's on the leading edge of innovation, we've got to start taking money out of politics. So the idea that I haven't run for 8 years raising money, or the idea that I haven't run for 2 years raising money, that's the way we should be. We should be doing the work to earn trust, not sitting on the phone with rich folks. And
which politicians talk about all the time. They're constantly raising money.
That's all you do. I remember, because in 2014, I had to stay on the phone trying to do everything I can to get resources. But does that really help you govern in the right way?
This is when you ran for Congress against David Valdeo.
That's right. Okay. And so I know the traditional way to run. But I believe if you're going to govern this state differently, you've got to start campaigning differently, too.
So how do you make your vision a reality? There's lots of things you want to do, but you know, the bottom line, it's going to cost money. Where's the money going to come from?
So there's a couple of things. One, I do believe some of it is about money. So the idea that we spend so much on our prison system, we've got to really take a look at what our values are when it comes to spending on our prison system versus our education system. But I think there's something else here, which is having a strategy and a plan. The idea that we should be better coordinated of how we think about our state, whether that's healthcare, housing, or really economic development. Everyone does things sort of ad hoc. We're covering this crisis or that crisis. We need to take a business approach. I was a Harvard MBA. We need to take a business approach to looking at what is our true strategy and how do we start that conversation from the very beginning so you're not just covering holes and covering crises. So yes, some of it's about money, but some of it is about a way of thinking and a way of actually building public institutions to be organizationally sound and modern for the new era.
But go back to money. I'm going to press on that point a little bit. I mean, if you're going to implement some of these things, you're going to probably have to find some money somewhere. So what about modifying Prop 13? That's the third rail of California politics. What about taxing services that aren't currently taxed? I mean, is there something we need to do to change the tax structure to find some revenue to do some of the things that you think need to be done? Yeah.
So there's a major problem that we have in this state, and I'm not sure how many folks are aware of it, but the volatility in our revenue stream is very difficult. Imagine your entire household only lived off of bonuses one day or one year and not bonuses the other year. That's essentially what's happening in our structure, in our budgeting structure. So yes, do we have to look at opening up Prop 13? Yes. Do we have to look at sales tax? Yes. We have to bring it all to the table, not be afraid to have those kinds of discussions, to really start thinking about tax reform in a real way, because you just can't run a government or a household on the extremes. And
yeah,
right now, that's what we
have. That's interesting, because the LA Legislative Analyst Office is constantly talking about the volatility of our tax structure. Right. So up next, we're going to have an in-depth discussion of some of the hotter topics currently occurring at the state capitol, things like affordable housing and creating an adequate infrastructure for California's growing population. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking to Democratic candidate for governor Amanda Renteria about some of the current issues facing the state. Big issue is affordable housing. So the question here is, how do you deal with that problem? Do you deal with it with the government kind of spending its way out of the problem, bonds, tax credits, maybe bring back redevelopment agencies, or do you focus on, does the government focus on regulatory reform, like CEQA, things of that nature? What do you think? How do you fix that problem?
Both and all of the above. I'm sure you're hearing this from everybody. But the way I think about it is I was involved in really thinking through an industry in crisis. We had four questions. Number one, is there the finances to do it? Are we producing the right products? Can we distribute those products? And are we really having a long-term commitment? When you think about that, the finances, we've got to start with the housing bond. You just need that infusion for 3.5 million homes. Number two, do we have the products? I'd say we have the products, but no one can buy them. So we have to start looking at whether it's accessor ADUs, accessor dwelling units, whether it's small lot divisions, something that gives us a little bit more variety in the options so that people can enter. But that means the third, how do you distribute it? We've got to make sure our permitting and our zoning is fast-tracked so that we can get these different options online. And then the fourth, what will show that we have a long-term commitment is to redevelop, to basically have a redevelopment agency again.
A new form, like redevelopment 2.0.
Exactly.
But in terms of zoning and those things, does the state play a role, or is that a local control thing?
You've got to do it at each regional level. It depends. So I think there's a number of different ideas. For instance, in LA, they have moved commercial development property to residential. Can we mimic that same best practice in Northern California? And what are the barriers if we can't? They've worked on, in Northern California, they've worked on accessory dwelling units, right? These are the little homes behind
like
a home.
Granny flats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But not everyone has given, local jurisdictions haven't given, what are the process to doing that? And so this is why I believe it is a regional approach. This is why regional development agencies are really important, because what works in the Bay Area doesn't work in the Central Valley, doesn't work in L.A.
Well,
right?
You'll be happy to know that in Clovis, they actually did that. In Old Town Clovis, they have the lots are fairly large, yeah. The houses are on, and they're putting granny flats, and they're actually kind of copying what they did in Davis. So using the alleyways as kind of a walkway between, and so you can have an extended family, your parents be able to live with you in a pretty nice place. It's an interesting concept. So let's transition to highways and roads. Another big issue. State passed a $5.2 billion transportation tax per year, going to bring about $52 billion in over 10 years for more highways and roads and things of that nature. Was that a good idea?
I think it had been, 23 years or...
Quite some time.
before there had been any sort of increase. And, I mean, when you drive on our roads, you can see that something needs to be done here, that we need to make sure that we have upkeep, that we need to make sure that we have a modern transportation system if we want to have a modern economy that works. And for anyone that has actually had car troubles, we're spending an average of about $800 to fix your car because of what's happening.
Your front-end alignment.
That's right. That's right.
And the thing is, pay me now or pay me later.
That's right.
But your point, though, is well taken. People aren't really aware that the gas tax really hasn't increased in 20, 30 years.
That's right.
And so, yeah, we've fallen a little behind. What about mass transit, high-speed rail?
Listen, I have seen what happens in Fresno when you start to bring in 1,700 jobs for our kids in Fresno State or engineers. That kind of energy didn't exist when I grew up. Well, we didn't have something where there was a vision of opportunity where we could be connected to the rest of the state. As I see my nieces and one with disabilities, there's no other way she can get to other parts of her state. She can't drive. So the idea that we haven't invested here in mass transit, that we haven't invested in public transportation enough, is real to me. And what I see is there's a real opportunity. Now, I'm also a business person who gets that you have to have the funds to be able to truly move projects forward. And so we've got to look at how can we cut this up into segments where we can see a beginning and an end and see a tangible result. Because right now we're living in concepts, and it's easy to attack concepts, but we need to actually have the real track laid down and start to move.
Let me ask you about a very minor issue, and we'll move on. That's water. Just kidding. Okay,
yeah.
Huge issue, perennial issue.
Yes.
It's always going on, right? So what are your thoughts on dams, the Delta Plan, ground banking, conservation? How do we deal with California's water problem?
So first of all, let me just say, when you don't grow up here or you don't know what it's like to be through a drought, it's a completely different story. I mean, I remember the water sputtering out of the sink, right? And it's starting to turn brown, and you know you better stop showering because the next person's not going to have any water. That sort of pit in your stomach is what we need every single leader to have right now, because the water issue is real here. And it's real in a different way than anywhere else in the state. And what concerns me most is that everyone is focusing on the Delta tunnels as the solution to fix it all. But the truth is, construction isn't even going to start we're going to have to wait a year for that construction, 10 years before the entire thing is done. And in the middle of it, we can do more on recycling, we can do more on reservoirs. I have talked about since 2014 that we need to be expanding our dams, looking at Temperance Flat. Thank goodness.
Raising the San Luis Reservoir has been talked about.
That's right. That's right. And the idea that we're not really as focused on any of those makes me very nervous, because we have 10 years we've got to deal with. And I want to quit praying for rain. I actually want to see some action where we see a vision going forward and we're attacking it at all different levels.
But do you support the Delta project?
I do. I support one. I just support a tunnel that doesn't completely bankrupt our state because of the other issues we need to invest in: reservoirs, recycling, conservation. I'd love to see putting in some conservation goals in LA before we put a bunch of water down there.
Okay, so your priority would be conservation first, then going to tunnels and dams and things of that nature.
That's right. Okay. I know we need to do it all. So you can't do one then the other. You got to do it all at the same time, and that's my message here, which is you got to start it now.
Yeah, and water experts actually call that conjunctive use. Yeah. Doing everything. That's the full toolbox.
Okay. Conjunctive use.
So when we come back, we're going to talk to Amanda Renteria about some of other perennial issues like crime, poverty, jobs, and education. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Hepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking to former Chief of Operations for the California Department of Justice and current candidate for governor, Amanda Renteria. So let's talk about an issue that seems to be uppermost in most people's minds when they think of government, and that is public safety. Long-term trends on crime in California generally down. However, there's been a recent uptick in some crime statistics. Yeah. Is that a one-off anomaly, or is there something more happening here?
I believe it's actually a little bit of the canary in the coal mine, because when I've spent a lot of time with our younger generation, and they have real questions about whether or not they can trust our public institutions, whether we're talking about government or law enforcement. And I think we need to make sure that we're reconnecting to communities, particularly underserved communities, because people are feeling incredibly disconnected right now. And I worry that if we do not start to put systems in place or organizations in place or leaders in place that understand this idea that we've got to reconnect with our younger generation, with our communities of color, and with people who are really skeptical about public service and public trust, we're going to have bigger problems to come. And so my hope is that we actually see this as a warning, and we start to build the kind of programs that I worked on in the city of San Jose, where we were bringing communities and law enforcement together.
Yeah, it's kind of the proactive and reactive approach, right?
That's right.
Both dealing with it before it's a problem, and if it is a problem, then doing what you need to arrest folks if you need to. Let me ask you about kind of something goes back to your original point about One California, and that this idea of a two-tier economy. And you look at the Valley, the Central Valley, and the coast, very different economically. You know, the Valley, twice as high unemployment as the coast. How do you correct this economic imbalance?
Elect somebody from the Central Valley who gets it. I joke, and at the same time, I'm serious, mm-hmm. because often we are completely left out of discussions. People often drive right through. They don't see what's happening here. And we don't really have leaders at the highest levels going and saying, all right, bring your business to the Central Valley. Let's talk about how we can make that possible. Because we have talent. We have great kids in all parts of our state. And unless we start thinking about our state as a place that must be for all, we simply aren't going to reach our own potential. And there's something about the moral and character message here that we care about everyone, and for far too long we have left certain parts of our state out of the discussion, and that's where I grew up. Mm-hmm. So I feel incredibly passionate about this.
Do you think there are specific programs, tax credits, focused programs to help areas with high economic need?
Absolutely. There are obviously opportunity zones. There are, and again, this is where I go back to those redevelopment agencies. Mm-hmm. This is an opportunity to put in place some redevelopment agencies with some clear goals and investment options, mm-hmm. so that you can start building what the actual city needs. Those are the kinds of programs that are important. And then the other piece, education.
Great. The perfect segue, because that's the next thing I want to ask you about. You know, we have a situation in California. I know you actually started as a teacher in Woodlake.
After you graduated
from Stanford, which is interesting. But, you know, there's a large number of historically underserved students in California. Latino population make up more than half of California's public school population. We've got 1.4 million English learning students in California. How do you prepare that group for the 21st century?
So I see a number of different things we have to do. First, universal pre-K. The idea that at age 4, this state is already behind is absurd. We should be on the front edge of that. We know the number of words you know by the age of 9 determines your success. Number 2, we've got to bring arts back into elementary education so that we're expanding. We know that creativity and that kind of talent makes a difference. 3, we got to make sure that all high school students, I was a high school teacher when I came here, have coding and computer as a requirement. State of West Virginia, Arkansas, they have it as a requirement. And California doesn't, when we're the center of technology. And by the way, that hurts your underserved areas even more because it increases that digital divide. And then the last piece is, as a high school teacher, I remember my kids, they wanted a lot of options. Some wanted to go to college, some wanted training, some wanted to go to community college. The idea that we are not making an easy link for a lot of those kids, we got to take a real look at that. Because if we aren't preparing those kids for when they graduate from high school, we're in trouble.
Yeah, there's some really good opportunities in community colleges for trades that people don't realize. There's some good paying jobs there. We're going to talk more with California gubernatorial candidate Amanda Renteria in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking to California gubernatorial candidate and former chief of operations for the California Department of Justice, Amanda Renteria, about some of the long-term issues that she's likely to confront if she is elected governor of California. Big issue is immigration, obviously. What are your thoughts on sanctuary cities?
Listen, I think we need to protect our families, especially here in the Central Valley. I think one of our approach to sanctuary cities, our approach to immigrant families should be one of humanity. And the idea that we are separating kids from families is not who we are as Americans. It's not who we are as just people. And so my approach is, how do we make sure that we bring that trust, that community back together again, especially in a place like this where we know they're a part of our neighbors, they're a part of our workforce, they're a part of our ag economy, and we got to get back to that kind of conversation.
Okay, let me ask him about another big issue, healthcare. People are always worried about the cost of healthcare, the uneven access to healthcare in California. What's your prescription for the healthcare system?
So I worked in the United States Senate when we worked on the Affordable Care Act. I worked directly on maternity care, on women's productive care, on mental health parity. That ended up as one of the 8 essential benefits in the Affordable Care Act. I know it's complicated, I know it's difficult, but the first phase of the Affordable Care Act was really about how do you expand access, leave the system as it is. Now we're in the second phase, and the second phase is, okay, we have a lot more access, but how do you bring the cost drivers down? The only way you do that is through coordination. So going on the process of single payer has number one goal is coordination. And when you look at
You think that's going to bend the cost curve?
Absolutely. We knew that from the very first discussions of the Affordable Care Act.
People say that, you know, there was a discussion about single payer in California, and the speaker was saying that we can't do this. It's going to cost $400 billion.
We have not gone through a true implementation plan. I'll tell you, I know I was there when Affordable Care Act was a, should we go this route or this route? But the minute you start to say, how do we actually implement it? So that's when you start really tackling the questions of coordination, true coordination. And what I will say, had we started the Affordable Care Act discussion with a very coordinated idea, that was our goal, we'd have a very different system now. But hey, this is phase two. We're the state of California. And the idea that we can actually coordinate will drive down costs.
Okay.
The three biggest drivers are about coordination.
Right. Bending that cost curve has always been kind of the issue. But let me switch gears a little bit and talk about climate change and all of the rest of that. You know, NASA statistics, they say 97% of all actively publishing climate scientists say that climate change or climate warming trends are done to human activities. So it seems to be relatively settled science, at least according to NASA. But the studies also show that California only produces about 1% of all global emissions. How do you balance addressing the issue of climate change and not hurt the California economy in the process?
So I just believe you can do both, and we've seen it over the course of time. I remember the discussions that people said solar will never be an industry that's worth doing. We've seen it. We've opened up industries. In fact, in California, we have opened up an alternative energy industry, and you're seeing green jobs, you're seeing alternative energy jobs. You're seeing it here in the Central Valley, where people are looking at new and innovative products. I mean, even the idea that electric cars are out there. This is what I believe in California. We are on the cutting edge, and I'll never bet against us in terms of innovation because we have the talent, we have the smarts, and I know that really pushing us to think about how can you not only create jobs but improve our environment, that's within our power to do.
You know, one of the things about what's interesting, you mentioned electric cars. We just did a program on that, and one of the things they find is problematic with cars is this, envy in terms of how long the car is going to last, the distance envy situation. They said that they can change that with infrastructure by having more stations, plug-in stations. Would you be something supportive of that, expanding the number of plug-in stations so cars can charge?
I would. We've got to start looking at this. If we've had the same gas-powered cars since the very beginning, mm-hmm. and the idea that we can't innovate an industry, that's not who we are as California.
It's interesting because there's been an exponential increase in the number of electric cars, and it's looking like it's going to continue. One last question. You've only got about 45 seconds, so here we go. Unfunded pension liability, both general public employee pensions and public employee retirement, health care, big issues, billions of dollars. How would you deal with those issues?
One, you got to start having the discussion now. I was a part of the auto industry figuring out this same exact issue on pensions. And we've got to start talking about what does it mean for the future? How do you deal with current and future pensioners? And at the same time, making sure we're not changing the rules on someone when all of a sudden they're nearing retirement, but talking about, is there something we can do before then? It's a tough discussion.
Yeah, that's a very tough discussion. And usually when we talk about that topic, we get a lot of comments from public employees. But I want to thank Amanta Renteria, who's the former chief of operations of the California Department of Justice and current Democratic candidate for governor, for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.